haunting opening strains of In Memoriam by Arnold Bax. Written in memory of Porrick Pierce, this is almost certainly the first orchestral piece to commemorate the Easter Rising. Yet Bax was no Irishman, but an English composer who would end his life with a knighthood and the position of Master of the Queen's Music, effectively Britain's Composer Laureate. Why, then, did he feel so moved to write a piece about a leader of a rebellion that sent shockwaves through the British political establishment? The story is a fascinating one. A young man inspired by a poetic vision of Ireland, a composer who became part of a Dublin circle of literary revival poets, a meeting with a future revolutionary, and an overwhelming sense of loss when the leaders of the Rising were executed. Underpinning it all is the remarkable identification of an English composer with Ireland, its people, its culture, and its historical suffering. What prompted Bax, a 19-year-old London student with no Irish ancestry, to go to Ireland for the first time in 1902? Bax scholar Graham Parlett explains.
In 1902, he came across Yeats's poem, The Wanderings of Usheen, and within a moment, the Celt within me stood revealed, is the phrase he used.
Your questioner, Usheen, is worthy. He comes from the Fenian lands. Half open his eyes were and held me, dull with the smoke of their dreams. His lips moved slowly in answer. No answer out of them came. Then he swayed in his fingers the bell branch, slow dropping a sound in faint streams, softer than snowflakes in April and piercing the marrow like flame. Wrapped in the wave of that music, with weariness more than of earth, the moil of my centuries filled me, and gone like a sea-covered stone were the memories of the whole of my sorrow and the memories of the whole of my mirth. And a softness came from the starlight and filled me full to the bone.
As soon as he had discovered his Irish interests, he visited Ireland for the first time, and he was very fond of going to the most obscure places on the Atlantic coast in the northwest of Ireland, and he soon discovered the village of Glencolumbkill in Donegal, where he would stay for many months at a time, and he became very friendly with the inhabitants. He started learning the Irish language. In the end, he could read it perfectly fluently, but he was always rather shy about speaking it in front of native speakers.
The magic of Yeats's early poetry left a profound and lasting impression on Bax. Almost 50 years later, he would say how Yeats's poetry always meant more to me than all the great music of the centuries. All the days of my life, I bless his name. His initial response to it was by no means unusual for the period, according to Roy Foster, professor of Irish history at Oxford University.
Well, a lot of Yeats's early poetry released the inner Celt in people who didn't literally have a Celtic bone in their body, whatever that means. Wanderings of Usheen was a marvellous mixture, if you like, of romance and exoticism cast in a Celtic mode, deliberately using very Irish words that you'd have to know how to pronounce, but written in an incantatory, almost Tennysonian, wonderful narcotic kind of rhythm with marvellous imagery. It is an astonishingly accomplished poem for a tyro, as Yeats then was. I think this is the kind of work that magnetised people like Bax. And it was, I suppose, having its maximum influence around the turn of the century, the early 1900s, which is exactly when Bax becomes so excited by it.
Glencolumbkill in Donegal became almost a second home for Bax over the next decade. Here he began to acquaint himself with Irish culture.
he began to write poems and short stories inspired by the Donegal coast and learnt the Irish language. He would certainly have been surrounded by traditional Irish music. Glen Columbkill had a rich tradition of fiddle music, and its practitioners ranged from those who could play only two or three tunes to professionals who toured the countryside. Max became sufficiently accepted in the local community that he became acquainted with some of these fiddlers. In his autobiography, Farewell My Youth, he recalls encountering a member of the famous Doherty family of travelling musicians. Conor Caldwell of Queen's University Belfast.
The Dohertys now would be among the most famous musicians from southwest Donegal. They would have had roots that went all the way back to the Gaelic aristocracy before the time of the flight of the Earls. I suppose the person from that clan that Bax mentions the most is Mickey McConnell, who would have been an uncle of the Doherty, was married into the Doherty family. Bax refers to him several times of playing the air, the Coolin, to the extent that it made the performer Mickey cry or weep as he was playing the tune, which I think is a really lovely thought, to think of the emotion that that he felt under the weight of the music and the tradition and all of what he was at the time, and playing this very beautiful old Irish air.
In his autobiography, Bax recalls how, during this period, he tried to develop a Celtic curve in his compositions. This curve bore little resemblance to the traditional music he would have heard in Donegal, but was instead his own personal musical reaction to the landscapes and seascapes all around him in Glen Columbkill. Bax's biographer, Lewis Foreman.
Basically, he was consciously attempting to recall things he'd actually heard, and not only musical ones. And I mean, the amazing thing is, very often he's not writing harmony, he's writing sound. And once he gets into later works where some of the strikingly original chords and usage was actually Bax trying to replicate something in musical notation which actually was coming to him as sound, i.e. he wasn't hearing chords, he was hearing the noise of the sea, or something of the sort.
This geographically inspired sound world, with its constant evocation of the sea, would become a recurring feature in Bax's orchestral music. Certain instruments, particularly the flute, harp, and celeste, are used frequently, providing decorative accompaniments, as can be heard in the opening of his symphonic poem of 1916, The Garden of Fand.
Thank you.
This sound world was Bax's route to the hidden Ireland that he felt was missing in the works of genuine Irish composers. Harry White, Professor of Music at University College Dublin.
Well, that's almost perhaps the key question about Arnold Bax's music and about his early orchestral works. Everybody knows about his immersion in things Irish, and to some extent he almost compares to John Synge in that regard. I mean, Bax knew Irish, he learnt Irish. He spent so many years in Glencolumbkill, he knew the wilds of Donegal. He knew something far beyond, in fact, the cosmopolitan milieu of Dublin and, you know, Yeats writing his poetry from the writing room of a London club and so on. He was very much engaged with the Irish hinterland, as it were. The question of Irishness in Bax's music is one of comparative degree. And the reason I say that is because so many previous composers or earlier composers had foundered upon the difficulty of trying to reconcile what was a self-standing and very robust but very constricting approach to Irish music, as in quoting entire folk songs or traditional airs and immerse these airs in the dress or apparel of late 19th or early 20th century orchestral dress. Bax doesn't do that, but as the years go by, it does strike me that Bax's music sounds more and more Irish rather than less and less. And I think it's absolutely because of this affinity between his own, as Foreman calls it, this neo-Irish style or neo-Irish folk song that Bax synthetically creates, and the tunes themselves. And so in the early tone poems, and particularly the Irish ones, the ones that are inspired by Irish mythology and at least indirectly by Yeats, the Irish intonations seem to me to be stronger now rather than weaker.
Bax moved to Rathgar, Dublin, in 1911 and would live there until 1914. He soon became part of a Dublin literary circle headed by the poet and mystic George Russell, otherwise known as A.E. Bax felt at home in this group. He had already published a volume of poetry under an Irish pseudonym, Dermot O'Byrne, that was influenced less by Yeats than by the so-called Celtic twilight, figures like A.E., and the Scottish poet Fiona MacLeod. Roy Foster.
When it comes to releasing your inner Celt, Fiona MacLeod is essential and a much traduced figure after her early popularity. Fiona MacLeod turns out to be the alter ego of William Sharp, who's a journalist who adopts Celticism and writes in the persona and mode of a Scots, it's always implied, very aristocratic Scotswoman called Fiona MacLeod, who's very elusive and is forever disappearing on boats to the Far Hebrides when she's supposed to meet her fellow Celtic writers, and is a construct. It's very interesting the extent to which Yeats and A.E. know she's a construct, or when they find out that she's a construct. But earlier in her, Fiona's publishing career, when she's writing books like Green Fire and The Winged Destiny, she's very much in the swim and in the fashion of all things Celtic in the 1890s. Certainly, by the turn of the century, Yeats and A.E. have rumbled her. And I think A.E. writes to Yeats that whenever Fiona pops her head up out of the astral light, he will whack it. It's interesting that Bax continues to patronise the work of Fiona, which has a fairly brief fashion and by serious Irish writers is, I think, pretty well written off by the early 1900s.
It was as part of this literary group that Bax was known in Dublin, rather than as a composer. His music wasn't performed in Dublin, but in London. In some ways, he almost led a double life, as a literary figure in Ireland and as a composer in England, where his Celtic-inspired works were beginning to attract critical attention. These included the 1908 symphonic poem Into the Twilight, the first of an orchestral triptych that the composer called Era. Towards the end of his life, Bax claimed that he could not recall anything of musical activity in Dublin when he lived there, save a recital by Quarto, a week of Pavlova at the Gaiety, and Thomas Quinlan's operatic company giving for the first time in Dublin Tristan and Die Walküre. In fact, there was a lot more music going on in Dublin than Bax acknowledges. Maria McHale, DIT Conservatory of Music and Drama.
There was quite a lot of classical music being performed in Dublin. The Dublin Orchestral Society was established in 1898. There were lots of chamber and vocal music concerts at various venues because Dublin had a relatively large number of theatres, all of which included classical music on their schedules. So places like the Gaiety Theatre, which is still in existence, the Theatre Royal, the Queen's Theatre and Leinster Hall. In fact, the Abbey Theatre had its own orchestra. Now, it was quite a small ensemble, but it performed a large quantity of music during the intervals. And this music would be movements from symphonies, opera overtures, arrangements of Irish tunes, a real mixture of music, but music that really reflected contemporary classical music tastes. There were lots of performances of opera, and this came about largely from travelling opera companies, such as the Doyley Cart Company, who performed the comic operas of Gilbert and Sullivan, and the Carl Rosa Opera Company, among many others. It's fair to say that there was a considerable appetite for opera in Dublin, which has something to do with the fact that it was relatively inexpensive to go to the theatre at the time, but also there was a growing middle class with money to spend on entertainment. It's astounding, really, to consider that during the early years of the 20th century, there could be anything up to 50 nights of opera being performed each year in Dublin.
Through AE's literary circle, Bax became acquainted with the politics of Irish nationalism and some of nationalism's leading artistic advocates. His closest friends were the poet Porrick Colum and his wife Molly. Other acquaintances included advanced nationalists like James Stephens, Ernest Boyd, Daryl Figgis and Thomas McDonough. Many of these figures were Sinn Féin-leaning in their politics. Some of them, most notably McDonough, would later be active in the Rising itself. A notable absentee, however, was Yeats, who by now espoused a pro-Home Rule stance that was anathema to many in AE's circle. Roy Foster again.
The revolutionary generation in Dublin at this time tend to see Yeats as somebody of the older generation who has become a collaborator with English values, who is endorsing Redmond's Home Rule movement, who is keeping political theatre out of the Abbey, which is why many of them leave the Abbey and set up agitprop theatre companies elsewhere around Dublin. Constance Markovich, one obvious example, Joseph Plunkett another, both of whom will fight and both of whom be condemned to death after the Easter Rising. Yeats is consciously distanced from these people at the very point, I should think, when Bax is consciously and rather romantically and even sentimentally trying to identify with them.
During his time in Dublin, Bax had a meeting that would have a profound effect on him. Molly Colum had long been keen for Bax to meet Porrick Pearce and persuaded Pearce to attend a salon at their house when she knew Bax would be present. What followed was almost certainly the only meeting between the two men. Graham Parlett takes up the tale.
Well, Molly Colum was always eager that Bax should meet Pearce. And in his autobiography, Farewell My Youth, Bax quotes her as saying, "You must meet him, Arnold. Sure, you would get on together like sworn brothers. But the trouble is, he's a very difficult fish to land. He always refuses to go to any sort of party." But in the end, Molly did succeed in luring Pearce to visit Bax's house. And Bax continues, "I began to talk to him of his native Connemara, which I knew well, and he became quite animated when I spoke in lively detail of places on that ultimate seaboard that it's unlikely that anyone else in the room had ever heard of. Said Molly by my side, 'My goodness, Mr. Pearce, would you ever have supposed that this fellow was an Englishman? Well, replied Pierce quietly, with the ghost of an ironic smile, I'm half English myself. As he was leaving that night, he said to Molly, I think your friend Arnold Bax may be one of us. I would like to see more of him.
What did Pierce mean by one of us? Perhaps he saw Bax as a future revolutionary, or at least a fellow traveller. He would certainly have recognised someone who had come to know rural Ireland from the inside. But Pierce may also have sensed in Bax a psychological need to proclaim an Irish identity that was a feature of other members of the revolutionary generation.
When Pierce says to Molly Cullen that Arnold Bax is one of us, which Bax is very proud of retrospectively, I think it's because of that romance of the West, the pure Gaelic Ireland, the sense of something unmaterialist, un-English, idealist and idealized. And I think it's this question of an overcompensating identification with that notion of the prelapsarian purity of the West, which probably answered to something in Pierce. In that same evening, the conversation is reported by Bax, Pierce remarks that he, Pierce, is half English. And like many of the people who made the 1916 revolution, there was, I think, a sense of being, so to speak, insecurely Irish. A great many of these people had lived in England or had an English parent or had a missing father or had a need to find an anchor in the Gaelic culture of across the Shannon, of the seaboard, of the literal, was very, very strong.
On Easter Monday 1916, a small body of Aran men entered the GPO Dublin and converted it into a fortress. Over the building, they hoisted the tricolour. They published a proclamation of independence signed by seven of their leaders who constituted a provisional government for the Republic of Ireland. In this proclamation, they called upon the men of Ireland to strike a blow for the independence of their country. A division of opinion at headquarters prevented a simultaneous rising all over Ireland and left a few small units in Dublin to face the military machine of England alone. England was free to concentrate her forces in Dublin. The centre of the city was bombarded. After 5 days, the heroic government of the Republic decided, in order to save the civilian population, to surrender. Following the surrender, the president and the 6 other members of the provisional government were shot. The commanding officers of the principal outposts of the insurrection were also shot. English soldiers raced up and down through Ireland. They raided halls and private homes and carried some 3,000 prisoners across the sea to jails and internment camps in England.
Bax was staying in the Lake District in northern England when he heard the news of the Easter Rising. He was stunned by what had happened. In a letter to his mistress, the pianist Harriet Cohen, he wrote, "All day, my thoughts have been a strange mingling of you and the sudden dramatic Irish rebellion. I can't help feeling very strongly about all this. Do you understand? I want to talk to you about Ireland's recent history some day." He wrote again to Cohen on the 4th of May, the day after Pierce was executed. Graham Parlett.
Pierce was executed on the 3rd of May, 1916, and on the following day, Bax wrote to the pianist Harriet Cohen, "So poor Pierce was shot yesterday morning. It's a wonderful world, isn't it? He was one of the most wholehearted idealists that I have ever met, and I know that all he did was rooted in love, love for Ireland." A few months later, he wrote again to Harriet, "I want to write something about Ireland, a dream piece untroubled by anything. It's time I did something like this." He then started thinking about the piece that ultimately became In Memoriam for orchestra. In July, he wrote to Harriet, A lovely melody came to me the other day when I felt most unhappy. It was strange how it came, I think, from the dream world that we know, you and I. And this is the wonderful melody that occurs after a few pages in In Memoriam.
Bach's composed In Memoriam, subtitled In Memory of Porrick Pierce, during the summer of 1916. This piece begins atmospherically in the style of the Garden of Fand, broadens into a noble, heroic march, and then becomes more funereal. At the centre of the piece is a battle scene, whose music later reappears triumphantly during the reprise of the march. The work ends with an otherworldly transformation of the funereal music. Is the composer trying consciously to tell a story in this piece? Bax doesn't admit to a programme, but it isn't hard to infer one. An idealistic nationalist movement whose origins lie in centuries of oppression, a defeated rebellion, a transfiguration of the dead leaders, and a hope that from the defeat may come future victory. It is thus less a depiction of the events of Easter 1916 than a musical account of the vision that Pierce and others had enacted in the Rising. Harry White.
Who knows Pierce? You know, that business of Pierce always being photographed in profile is so emblematic of the enigma that surrounds this personality. And in fact, you know, if I said who knows Pierce, it's a rhetorical question that doesn't require an answer. But again, referring back to Bax's memoirs and Farewell My Youth and so on, I mean, he is in the one meeting with him, he is captivated by this dream vision and Molly Colum saying to him, you know, Pierce wants to die for Ireland. So I don't know if the poem, if the memoriam ever attempts to really get to grips with a fully rounded portrait of Pierce's actual personality. But I think rather it addresses his visionary status and the ennoblement, as it were, of his achievement. Because he does want to die for Ireland. He did die for Ireland. But Pierce's enterprise is prefigured by this kind of dream vision, this artistry, and he's an educator and so on and so forth. So, you know, there is something quintessentially romantic about Pierce's mission.
The piece departs from Bax's earlier works in one particular respect. Graham Parlett.
In a letter to Harriet Cohen, he said, "My new piece is nearly all sketched out in 3 days. It's an elegy in memory of Pierce and has one quotation which would quite remove it from the sympathy of a British audience, if it were recognised, which is in all probability unlikely." This quotation, musical quotation, comes from the song called The Memory of the Dead, which is better known by its first line, "Who fears to speak of 98? Later adapted by Brendan Behan as "Who fears to speak of Easter week?" The original words, which refer to the Irish Rebellion of 1798, were written by Dr. John Kells Ingram, when he was still a student at Trinity College Dublin, and they were later set to music by William Elliot Hudson. So Bax deliberately quotes this theme, which on its first appearance is marked in the full score fierce and strident. So he obviously meant it to make a big impression.
Bax would probably have encountered this song at one of the salons he attended in Dublin. His use of it in Memoriam is surprisingly similar to that of old-fashioned ballad singers who applied new words to existing tunes to make a political point. Conor Caldwell.
Throughout the history of the Irish singing tradition, people have always recast old melodies with new words for something that's current. So as the English ballad tradition really grew and the English language, use of the English language exploded in Ireland through the 1800s, we see this as a very common way of constructing new songs. So, for example, George Petrie, the collector, has several airs which he says, I learned this from, you know, a Dublin ballad singer. It's an air that's often used for a particular type of ballad. Similarly, there are airs that were associated with laments for dead people, priests or politicians or important people within the community, and those airs would have been used over and over again for new compositions. So what happens here in 1916 is that someone, we're not quite sure how it came about, recasts the old tune from 98 to a new set of words to commemorate the executions in 1916.
Who fears to speak of Easter week, that week of famed renown, when the boys in green they went out to fight the forces of the crown, with Mauser's bold and hearts of gold, the Red Countess dressed in green, and high above the GPO, the rebel flag was seen.
And the song gains very quickly gains popularity. There are reports of musicians being arrested in Dublin for playing it. So the authorities are obviously somewhat concerned about the song's, role in spreading sedition in the city. And of course, the British government for over a century had been very interested in the way that song was used to foment political insurrection. And one of the great things that they created by accident is this collection of ballads in Dublin Castle, which the various agents around the country were sending back to the authorities, reporting on sedition in various parts of the country. So it's very interesting that this tune is recast. It's very relevant to the time. So, I don't think Bax would have heard this in Donegal. This would be very much from his Dublin excursions. But he's very, very quick to include it. So I think it gives you an idea of the relevance of the piece at the time. It's very much Bax responding immediately to what has happened. It's his own personal response, but he actually manages to incorporate then something of the response of the people of Dublin. There are reports in other books of the song being sung anywhere and everywhere, in shops, in concerts, and as I said earlier, gaining popularity at the time. So he very much responds to that in the way that he knows how to. You know, that this is one of, I think, only two examples of Bax directly quoting Irish material in his music.
Here we have the tune that you have transcribed of Who Fears to Speak of Easter Week. Would you be able to play it, perhaps?
Yeah,
just for comparison.
It's a transcription I made of the piper Leo Rosen playing this tune, I think in the 1950s.
Of a rebel song certainly suggests a realism and an immediacy that had been missing from Bax's Irish-influenced works hitherto. Does that make Bax a rebel composer? He certainly began to think of In Memoriam as a rebel piece, as he voluntarily suppressed the work. For reasons that Lewis Foreman explains, it would not receive its premiere until the 1990s.
It had apparently been in a publisher's basement the whole time. And I suspect that means that Bax had left it with Goodwin and Tabb and that when Goodwin and Tabb were taken over, they just remained in collections. Nobody actually listed it. They may have known they'd got it, but they didn't know its significance until eventually I was approached wearing my Bax Trust hat and said, this score, which they thought belonged to the Bax estate, and eventually it was handed over. That's all. And then I had it, but actually going from that to a performance, even though I immediately showed it to Vernon Handley, it took a long, long time for us to find a taker of anyone wanting to do it. With all these things, with even with works which become celebrated, the difficulty of persuading people to actually get to grips with them, or even how good they are, you'd be amazed how many people want to conduct something after the first performance who either couldn't be bothered to read the score or hadn't realised the significance of the score. Now the Bax Trust certainly put up money for lots of recordings, and I think we probably did for this one, for Chandos to record it. But it was only when Vernon Handley actually conducted it, because this one was never done by an amateur orchestra, which most of the others were. So there was no demo tapes. And the fact that it was the tune was from Oliver Twist, when film music wasn't very well thought of, didn't exactly sell it. As soon as they'd heard it, my God, that's a whole different ballgame.
As a result, for many years, the march that lay at the heart of the work, the theme that Bax felt came from a dream world, but which seems to express the nobility of Pierce's aspirations for an independent Irish Republic, was associated only with its use in David Lean's 1948 film Oliver Twist. Yet, curiously, this theme is almost cinematic even in its original use. It is as if Bax is giving us a camera close-up of Pierce, and then zooming out to give a panoramic vision of the country that he hoped to lead.
Bach's, like William Walton, has a natural affinity for landscape and for the picturesque and for that aspect of narrative and music in terms of drawing a portrait of something. And he always strikes me as a very filmic composer. I mean, not just because we know that he used the great theme from In Memoriam in Oliver Twist, but just even, I think if one didn't know that, the music tends to amount to, or as it were, aspire to, some kind of landscape or some kind of unfolding of a visual representation. Pursuing that idea of a composer whose musical instincts relate to landscape or to narrative makes more and more sense when you think of Bach's own alternative persona as a writer and the perforce in Dublin, so that his descriptive powers as a musician presumably relate to his narrative impulses as a writer.
The sense that In Memoriam might be about more than just Pierce comes across even on a first listening. Lewis Foreman again.
When Todd Handley was recording In Memoriam, which I seem to remember was in Manchester, the next item to be recorded was Margaret Finger playing the left-hand piano concerto. She didn't know anything about In Memoriam, and she came into the control room exactly at the moment that the big tune is first played, right towards the beginning. And she was absolutely overwhelmed by it. Well, she was almost in tears. And she said, "What on earth was that? It sounds like a love song." It's just a very striking, gripping piece, and it's given that edge by the sources from which he took it. But, I mean, Banks didn't have to suppress it. If he'd produced it after the war as In Memoriam and not told anybody what it was about, he would have been made.
In some ways, In Memoriam is almost a love song to Ireland. It's clear from the poetry Banks wrote following the Rising that he was devastated not only by the sense of personal loss, but by the destruction of the Ireland that he remembered. The hidden Ireland of the West that Banks felt he had found in Glencolumbkill, and which was idealised by A.E.'s circle of poets, was a long way from the destruction of central Dublin. Banks's poetry, rather than his music, is where he expresses his anger at the British response to the Rising, above all in his 1918 collection, A Dublin Ballad and Other Poems, which was banned by the British censor.
Oh, write it up above your hearth and troll it out to sun and moon. To all true Irishmen on earth, arrest and death come late or soon. Some boyo whistled 98 one Sunday night in College Green, and such a broth of love and hate was stirred ere Monday morn was late as Dublin town had never seen. And godlike forces shocked and shook through Irish hearts that lively day, and hope, it seemed, no ill could brook. Christ, for that liberty they took, there was the ancient deuce to pay. And when at last the golden bell of liberty was silenced, then he learned to shoot extremely well at unarmed Irish gentlemen. Ah, where were Michael and Gold Moll and Seamus and my drowsy self? Why did fate blot us from the scroll? Why were we left upon the shelf?
The graphic realism of A Dublin Ballad is a long way from the nature mysticism of Bax's A.E.-inspired poems, and it has left its mark in the canon of 1916 verse. Gerald Daw, Professor of Poetry at Trinity College Dublin.
Perhaps his best-known poem, though, of the time is A Dublin Ballad of 1916, where he describes what has taken place. No wonder it was banned, and the censor didn't take to it at all. But there's another curious thing about him, in that a significant element of these poems about the Rising of 1916 were channeled or recycled or sampled 50 years later. In the 50th anniversary of the Rising, we're now entering into the 100th, where the Irish state used some of these paragraphs or stanzas, should I say, in some of their publications. So, I mean, O'Byrne was identified in the Irish public diplomatic psyche as being a justifying presence outside of the Irish revolutionary canon And that's significant. I think that's an interesting point. Why would the Irish Foreign Affairs, or when they were publishing their material in the 1966, why should they identify these elements in this rather bizarre figure, this composer, and with his other life? Yet they identify particular elements in his work as kind of, let's use the word, propaganda 50 years on. So he is an important figure from that point of view as well. Culturally, he presents an interesting question. Who owns 1916? Is it part of a diaspora? Is it part of a world movement whereby a figure such as Bax can actually identify himself with it, even though the whole point of the Rising was against the very nation that he would ultimately sing the praises of as well as a composer?
In 1949, Bax recalled how, on receiving an honorary degree from the National University of Ireland 2 years earlier, he came very near to feeling myself to be a naturalised Éireannach. Superficially, it is hard to square this naturalisation with the cut-glass vowels of his voice, as in the following conversation with Eamon Andrews. But it is clear from this interview that Bax's knowledge and love of Ireland is profound.
Well, have you any comment now to make on the fact that there is such an Irish atmosphere in a lot of your compositions?
Well, I can't say anything about that definitely. I think I must have derived it from the mountains, woods and streams of Ireland itself.
But how did you become so interested in Ireland in the first place?
Well, in the first place, it was reading the Wanderings of a Sheen, W.B. Yeats, the age of 19. That set me off on the path to the West, which I never regretted.
And that has had this influence on your work?
Yes,
Is it a fact that you went so far in this study that you studied the Irish language as well?
Yes, I did. I studied it for years. I never got on very far with it in the matter of speaking, but I could read it pretty easily.
What was your reason for studying it?
Because I wanted to get to the depths of Ireland, the hidden Ireland, as Corkery calls it.
Well, now, can you tell us what your musical plans are for the future?
Oh, easily. I have none at all.
All right. Well, now, among all your works, I suppose, or could you tell us what you consider your best work?
Well, I couldn't say what is my best work. I should have to leave that to somebody else. Mm. But I can say which is my favourite work, and that's The Garden of Fenn, which is perhaps the most Irish of them all.
Well, I wonder, is that why you consider it your favourite work?
I think that is so, probably, yes.
Does that mean that we should think of Bax not just as an honorary Irishman, but as an honorary Irish composer? Harry White.
Does it really matter where he came from when you look at what happened to his music as a result of Ireland? I don't really see any material difference between Bax's enchantment with Ireland and John Singh's. I really don't. The fact that John Singh happened to be born in Ireland and Bax didn't really is immaterial. That doesn't mean that, that after Fand and Tintagel that, you know, he says goodbye, as it were, to the immediate inspiration of Irish music, which I think is true. And I think that, at least, you know, as I said, he looks further north. But his formative years as a composer and these enduring works entitle him to be regarded as part of the Irish musical landscape, and that's really what I would wish to claim. Isn't it very interesting that, you know, as we approach 2016, that we should be looking to the work of an English composer whose engagement with Ireland seems to me to be not only formative but profound? When Pearce, anecdotally or otherwise, says, I think Bax may be one of us, I think he knows what he's talking about, because he's recognising that quintessential Irishness which comes from somebody outside adopting it.
So while Bax may not have been Irish, the context in which his music was conceived, and in literary terms the context to which it belongs, unquestionably was, whether the music is inspired by mythology or historical events. For in these two works, In Memoriam for Orchestra and the poem In Memoriam My Friend Patrick H. Pearce, Ruler of Ireland for 1 Week, the mythology and history of Bax's Ireland become one.
For what last music did your thought await that rainy morning in the barrack yard? Fronting those narrow cylinders of fate while the slow seconds pulsed on, dull and hard. Ah, we that loved you hoped that death was kind and lapped about you a small sleepy wind born on a western hill and echoing frail old beauty from a Connemara hearth. For whispers of some dateless wonder tale, all you loved best on this fantastic earth.
Bach's Ireland and 1916 was written and presented by Aidan Thompson and produced by Ono Kelly. The reader was Andrew Bennett.